Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Today we have Bob Freeling. He's a speaker at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, Seattle, Washington, October 21st to the 24th, and he believes that energy is not just a luxury for mankind any longer, but a basic human right. And then there's Sheila Kerr going to come into the second half hour. She's with Windstream, and she's going to tell what happens when the wind doesn't blow and the sun doesn't shine. All right, right now we have with us Bob Freeling. If you've been listening to the program and hear us talking about the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference going on in Seattle, Washington, October 21st through the 24th, you know that Bob's a keynote speaker. And we're so proud to have him with us today, kind of giving us a preview of what he's going to talk about at the event. Bob is Executive Director of the Solar Electric Light Fund. That's a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization that has been on the cutting edge of delivering solar solutions to rural villages since 1990. Bob, thanks for being on the program.
Oh, you're most welcome. It's my pleasure.
Now, you've got a couple of things you want to talk about. You have the concept of energy as a human right, and I'm real interested in getting into that. But tell us about this the organization that you have that delivers solar solutions to rural villages. You've been doing this since 1990. Now, these are rural villages around the world, or are they in the United States too?
For the large part, in developing countries, the Solar Electric Light Fund, or SELF as the acronym goes, has been focused on delivering basic energy services primarily to parts of the world in developing countries that have never been connected to an electric power grid. And right now, out of a global population that exceeds 7 billion, there are approximately 1.5 billion people, 20% of humanity, that still live without access to electricity, something that we have grown up with and taken for granted for most of our lives here in the developed world.
Did you say 20% of humanity does not have access to electricity? Was that the figure you gave?
20%, 1.5 billion people. So we're not talking about a small niche market. We're talking about a very sizable portion of humanity. And if you go to sub-Saharan Africa, and if you go especially to, you leave the capital cities and go to the rural areas, there you find the rates of electrification dismally low. In many instances, only 10% of the rural population in sub-Saharan Africa actually has access to electricity, which means no lights when the sun goes down at night. These folks are forced to retire into homes that are lit, if at all, by dim, smoky, polluting kerosene lanterns or candles or nothing. So they are basically living in the dark. And if you look at a satellite image of Earth at night, you will see this sad reality very clearly in the image of you know, North America and Europe all lit up, and you see Africa essentially shrouded in darkness. So that satellite image of Earth is a very powerful image that I like to use to sort of graphically illustrate the reality that people on the ground have to deal with every single day. And in addition, of course, to light, the lack of electricity impacts people at a very fundamental level of their existence. It means there's no ability to pump or purify water. There's no way to store vaccines. You know, vaccines have to be refrigerated between 0 and 8 degrees centigrade. If they're not, they lose their potency. And immunization programs often break down in rural parts of the developing world because there's no way to preserve the so-called cold chain, and vaccines are lost. Without electricity, there's no way to have any kind of modern education, no way to operate computers, no way for children to go online and access the same kind of resources that children in the United States and Europe can. Without electricity, there's no way to irrigate unless it's done by hand. And, of course, the results or the ability to grow significant amounts of food when you're using, let's say, a hollowed-out gourd to water a garden is very limited. So basically the lack of electricity undermines every attempt for these rural communities to climb out of poverty and achieve a better quality of life.
Well, I've been told that the cell phones are pretty widespread because the infrastructure has never been quite built there, but they can't charge the cell phones because there's no way of charging the batteries. Is that a problem?
It is a problem, and it's true that cell phone technology has totally taken off. It's leapfrogged the landline infrastructure, and now you really have a hard time going to any part of the world that is not somewhere near a cell phone tower. So that's the good news. The bad news is that without electricity, you can't even charge a cell phone. So what you typically find are folks with generators that are set up in these rural communities that are using diesel power to charge cell phones at a very high cost, mind you. Or, in other cases, somebody might have a cell phone and they simply they can only use it every so often when they go to the nearest town and have access to electricity and they can recharge their cell phone.
Well, now you've been doing this since as a nonprofit since 1990. Is it your goal then to have solar power available to all these back countries around the world, and you're doing it with what, donations or something, or how does your organization work?
Well, that's a great question. Well, let me just go back historically and describe our early mission, because it has evolved. In the 90s, our primary focus was bringing solar lighting to people's homes, installing small, let's say, 50-watt photovoltaic systems directly on the roofs of individual families in a rural village, and providing enough power for them to operate a few lights, a radio, and maybe a black and white television for several hours each evening. Now, even though we are a nonprofit organization, we didn't believe in simply giving away these systems. We didn't believe that was going to be sustainable over the long term. On the other hand, asking a rural family to spend at the time cost maybe $400, $500 for a solar home system was prohibitively expensive for the vast majority of families. So the big sort of big breakthrough that Self made as an organization in the 90s was to use microcredit as a way of enabling families to pay for these systems over time. We would get grants, go into a rural community, install, let's say, 50 or 100 systems, but instead of making them pay upfront for the whole system, we would set up these payment mechanisms whereby they could pay for them over time, let's say 3-4 years, perhaps with a little bit of interest that would be collected by a local NGO, non-government organization that we would partner with, and the money would be put into a revolving loan fund that could be made available for other families that wanted to purchase solar home systems. So the idea was not to do 50 or 100 systems and walk away, but rather to set up a mechanism that could be self-financing over the long term. And we ultimately proved through a series of pilot projects that if you provide access to credit to these rural families, there is a sizable market of families in the developing world that are willing and able to pay for solar lighting at the household level. And the end result of all this experimentation was to launch a for-profit company in 1997 called the Solar Electric Light Company, or SELCO, which is based in Bangalore, India, and has gone on to install over 130,000 solar home systems on a commercial basis, working with local banks to finance these systems. You know, just as we buy homes and cars in this country, often they're financed, right? Well, we need to provide the same kind of financing for basic energy services. The problem with photovoltaics, it's cost-effective now. It's cheaper than kerosene lanterns over time, but the initial cost is often an impediment. So that's why providing innovative financing mechanisms which allow families and ultimately communities to pay for these systems is what is really needed to more to scale up the solutions around the world.
Yeah, that's pretty fascinating stuff. Now, these solar panels that you provide, are these largely made in China, or where do they come from?
Well, they're made all over. Historically, the United States was actually we pioneered the technology back in the 50s. Bell Labs came up with the first commercial application of solar cells to power a telephone repeater station. Mm-hmm. But at the time, the technology was literally astronomically expensive, and the only ones that could afford these solar cells was NASA to power these satellites that were being launched in space. Had it not been for the space race, where we desperately needed a source of power for these satellites that were being launched to compete with the Soviet satellites, the whole technology might have died in its infancy. But because we continued to rely on photovoltaics as a primary source of satellites, even to this day, the technology kept maturing. The efficiency with which these solar cells convert sunlight into electricity continued to go up over time, and the manufacturing processes continued to come down to a point where, beginning in the 80s and more in the 90s, it became more and more practical to use these solar cells for terrestrial applications, for village electrification and any number of other applications. Now, of course, it's now become mainstream here in this country and in Europe, especially in Germany, which was the first country to really start using feed-in tariffs to encourage homes and businesses to install these systems and be paid, you know, a decent fare or tariff for generating electricity that can be sold back to the grid. And I have a number of countries that have adopted these feed-in tariffs, and it's now a multi-billion dollar industry. The challenge for us now is how to take the improvements in technology and the reductions in cost and bring this back to the developing world where there's such a huge demand for basic energy services. China has become, you mentioned Chinese modules, they have now become the largest manufacturer of solar cells. And over the last couple of years, the price of these panels have, I think, come down by a factor of three.
Yeah.
So they are very cheap now, and solar electricity is becoming increasingly competitive with fossil fuel alternatives. And in the developing world, where the alternatives are either, you know, kerosene for household lighting or diesel generators for village power, solar photovoltaics has really come into its prime time now, where you're going to see, I think, over the next 5-10 years, an explosion in the use of solar energy for rural electrification.
Well, now, I hear that there's often problems with bandits digging up copper and destroying the facilities and that sort of thing. Is that been a problem with a lot of the places where you've tried to alleviate the problem of electricity?
In our case, less so, because we typically have worked very consciously and extensively with the communities. The projects that we've been implementing are really owned by the community, and I think that sense of community ownership has helped to instill a sense of responsibility for the equipment, and has, you know, I think lowered the chances that these systems are vandalized or stolen. It is a problem, because they are seen as a valuable commodity, but there are things that you can do to minimize that risk.
And your talk, your keynote address to the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference in Seattle, Washington, in October, you want to stress energy as a human right. You're saying it's the right of all peoples of the world to have energy. Is that what you're driving at?
Basically, yes. I'd like more and more people to start thinking about energy access as a critical component in the development process. Historically, energy has been overlooked. If you look at the Millennium Development Goals, for example, that were launched by the United Nations in the year 2000, this was a very bold and ambitious attempt to achieve universal primary education and reduce extreme poverty and lower infant mortality and improve maternal health and combat HIV/AIDS, malaria, things of that nature. And so I applaud the Millennium Development Goals. But at the same time, when they were launched, I realized that there had been a major omission by not including access to modern energy as one of the Millennium Development Goals. Because if you look carefully at these goals, you realize that without access to modern energy services, none of these goals are ultimately achievable. So for me, it was sort of an oversight. The good news is that there's been an evolution of thinking among many institutions worldwide, including the United Nations, which is actually just recently, back earlier this year, they announced that 2012 would be the year of sustainable energy for all. So Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has really championed this cause and really tried to elevate awareness about energy and its critical role in meeting the Millennium Development Goals and achieving a basic standard of living. So this is very encouraging to see this development. And now, as a result of the Sustainable Energy for All campaign that's now underway, you're seeing more and more commitments by governments, by presidents of heads of state of African countries, committing to achieving this idea of universal energy access by the year 2030. So I think with the kind of political will and commitments being made, policies put in place to develop the kind of regulatory framework and invite the private sector along with civil society to join forces with the public sector, I think we're going to see a lot more progress being made towards bringing basic energy services to these rural populations in the developing world.
Well, I was going to ask you for a prediction of the future, Bob, and I don't know if you just gave me one or not, but if you put on your meditation cap here for just a minute and really gaze down into the future, give us some timelines. What do you see? 5 years, 10 years, 50 years? Do you have a vision, a prediction for the future for us?
Let me put it this way. Back in, I think it was just 2000 or 2001, I actually made a quote-unquote long bet with the Long Bet Foundation, and I think you can find it. I think it's longbetfoundation.org, but you can Google it. Anyway, I made a bet back then that solar electricity would be as cheap or cheaper than that generated by fossil fuels by the year 2020, and I truly believe that prediction will come true, perhaps even sooner than we think. We are on the cusp of an energy revolution. As I mentioned, the cost of photovoltaics has been dropping precipitously over the last few years. There are companies working on next-generation batteries and energy storage technology, developments in other areas of renewable energy, wind and geothermal. So I think all of this is heralding a brave new world in which we are able to generate and distribute power cheaper and closer to where people live. And so I think a lot of people are going to be surprised at how quickly the transition takes place. That's not to say that oil and coal and natural gas won't be around. They will. But you're going to see these other alternative energy technologies, I think, grow very, very rapidly, providing, valuable services to people, especially in places that are deprived of energy completely now. That's where the greatest impact will be felt. It's going to be, I think, a fairly rapid transition, and you're going to see a lot of business opportunities as well emerge, being able to provide these energy services in an economic way. So it's a moral imperative to address the needs of these rural communities that are so desperate for power, for water, and for food security. We haven't got into food, but one of the more exciting projects that we've been doing the last few years is in Benin in West Africa, where we've combined solar water pumping with drip irrigation, working with women farmers who are now able for the first time ever to grow high-value fruits and vegetables during the dry season, which runs from November through April. Historically, during this time frame, there was essentially no food production, and diets were very restricted. Malnutrition was widespread. Now you go back to these communities where we're working, and these women are growing all kinds of leafy green vegetables, about 20% of which is consumed by themselves and their families. So there's been a very rapid improvement in health and nutrition of the community. The rest is sold to market. So on top of, you know, the food and nutrition benefits, they're actually generating income, which can be used for their health and education. So just total transformation of these communities, all thanks to a little bit of solar energy that is being used to pump water and irrigate crops. So it's really encouraging to see how a little bit of energy can go a long way to transform these lives.
Sure. Now, I understand you're also doing some health clinics. Can you tell us about what's going on there?
Sure. Well, this work in the health sector started a few years ago with a group called Partners in Health out of Boston, co-founded by Dr. Paul Farmer and Ophelia Dahl, doing wonderful work bringing modern healthcare services to the poorest of the poor, initially in Haiti, but ultimately they branched out and started to work in a number of African countries, including Rwanda, Lesotho, Malawi. Our work with them began in Rwanda, where we helped them basically replace the diesel generators they had been using to power their health facilities with solar solution. And the result has been greater reliability of power for their operations and lower costs. As I mentioned, solar electricity has now reached a point where it's cheaper than diesel over time. So it's an economic decision to go in and substitute solar systems or perhaps solar diesel hybrid solutions for the generators that were used previously. So we've now done a number of clinics now in Rwanda, Lesotho, many in Haiti. We've been working in Haiti for the last several years providing power to partners in health facilities as well as a number of other clinics. And it's very encouraging to see the health sector move in this direction away from fossil fuels to a more sustainable source of power. And we're hoping that the projects that we've done with Partners in Health can serve as a model, as a template for other players in the energy sector that can take the lessons learned and apply them in their own situations. This is going to be a great conference. I look forward to it. It's going to be a wonderful gathering of people that are committed to making the world a better place through technology, and I'm just thrilled to be a part of it.
Well, Bob Freeling, the executive director of the Solar Electric Light Fund and a keynote speaker at the IEEE Global Humanitarian Technology Conference going on in Seattle, Washington, the 21st through the 24th of October. Thank you so much for being with us. We really, really, really do appreciate you taking the time to be here today.
You're most welcome. Hope to have another opportunity soon to talk with you.
And for those of you who want to know more about the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, you can find out with a link to our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. Look on the right-hand side of your screen, and you'll see a link to the Global Humanitarian Conference going on in late October. And, of course, we've established now in the first half hour that energy for these depressed areas is an imperative, a basic human right, according to Bob Freeling. And but what happens when the sun doesn't shine or the wind doesn't blow? How do you get power then? Well, Sheila Kerr of Windstream, who's also an exhibitor at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, has an answer for that. So we're going to pick up with her the next half hour, so I hope you stick around. And before we get to the break of the half hour, our friend Melissa Drozdowski, the public relations chairman of the IEEE Life Sciences Grand Challenges Conference, has asked me to mention that they're having the conference October 4th through the 5th in Washington, D.C., and they've got a great speaker, Nobel and National Medal of Science laureate Philip Sharp of MIT is going to be there, so you're going to want to check that out. All right. We're going to break now at the half hour and come back in just a minute with Sheila Kerr and Windstream. So stick with us. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Frederick! Frederick Nietzsche. That does not kill us. makes us stronger.